I was born 100,000 years ago, and there's nothing in this world I do not know.
This is Heritage Unbounded, a podcast series of the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program in the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs at Johns Hopkins University. Join us as we keep our finger on the pulse of heritage in our changing world. We will talk with leading heritage professionals in the field and discuss the biggest challenges and accomplishments of heritage today.
Fell in love with me, poor girl. We were married in Milwaukee secretly. Then I snuck around and shook her, cause I went with General Hooker just to fight mosquitoes down in Tennessee.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sarah Chacon. I'm the director of the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program at Johns Hopkins University and your host for Heritage Unbounded. Each episode, we introduce you to a leading thinker in the heritage field and explore the latest issues in heritage both in the U.S. and abroad. No borders, just microphones. We are joined this episode by Elizabeth Galvin, an anthropologist and digital humanities specialist and head of learning and digital programs at the Victoria and Albert Museum, or the V&A as it's also called, located in the great city of London. We are going to be chatting about a major digital research project on African rock art that Elizabeth led at the British Museum, another wonderful London institution. But before we dive into that project, its scope, and some of the lessons learned, why don't you start by telling our listeners a little bit about your role at the V&A?
Hi, well, it's great to be here. And I think one of the things that's really fascinating about working at the V&A as opposed to a lot of my previous work is previously I very much worked in a digital curation world. I'm an anthropologist by training. But this role, I think, is a really fantastic one because it's working across the entire collection. So it's giving me the chance to kind of explore the breadth of collections that the V&A has, you know, which is a massive range of collections, but also work with digital outputs on each of those. So exploring different audiences and exploring different ways that we can engage with it.
Well, fantastic. So tell us a little bit about some of your daily tasks. Do you work on specific projects?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a mixed bag. I think that anybody who works in a museum recognizes that what your job description is and what you actually do sometimes can vary greatly. In fact, there was a moment out of grad school when I had to have a word with myself because I was just doing a lot of spreadsheets. And, you know, I was like, no, I went to grad school, so I didn't have to do this. No, that's not true. You're going to be doing a lot of spreadsheets and a lot of organization and planning that way. But what I think is great about my role and what I really love about it especially is that it really sits on this intersection between research. You know, I'm a researcher at heart, and I think that that's a really fantastic way to explore with the collections at the Victoria and Albert Museum. But then again, also working a lot with the digital program. So I run the digital programs team, which sits at the intersection also with digital marketing and publishing. That's our online team who create really excellent online content. But then also working with our digital curation departments and our learning departments too. So it's really at this nexus between all of these different groups of seeing how we can translate across each other. How can we translate the latest digital art into really great online postings and also in gallery spaces? How can we translate really fantastic research and bring that outside of the museum to engage certain audiences? And how can we best use technology to engage people with these collections? And that's at the core of what it is and why I really love working in museums in general.
Now, so some of the work that you did then as part of the African Rock Art Image Project. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and how that kind of translates into some of the stuff you do now, because I think there's definitely a nice segue there. Tell us a little bit about what that project was.
Absolutely. So before I joined the V&A, I was a curator at the British Museum, also in London. And as I mentioned before, I'm an anthropologist by training. So all of my work has been mainly in Southern and Eastern Africa. And this project was a really fantastic project, a chance to a very different type of project that I was used to. Because usually, obviously, when you are an anthropologist or work in a museum, you have one specific collection, you work in usually one region and, you know, collect various material culture and pieces and work on research from certain regions. This was a chance to look at the history of the continent of Africa through one lens of one type of object. And that object was rock art. And it was a really fantastic way to just approach this, because rock art obviously has such a, it's a medium of study. It's, you know, rock art from Morocco is not related to rock art from South Africa. But it's a chance to look across transversely about human history, because, I mean, this is one of the oldest forms of art. And the oldest scientifically dated rock art is about 28,000 years old, but it's thought to be a lot older than that. And some of the most recent rock art is actually less than 100 years old. So you're talking, you know, roughly 30,000 years of art. And when rock art is practiced, when it's such an old practice, especially, you can't apply modern political boundaries. A lot of times they were created by people who don't live in that region anymore. I mean, in some cases, they absolutely do live in that region, but I think it's the diversity of that. And what really drew me to running this project, especially, was that it's looking at some of the world's oldest art, but through a lens of some of the newest technology. So this was a chance to the British Museum. We acquired a copy of a collection from a fantastic organization based out of Nairobi, Kenya, called the Trust for African Rock Art. And so we acquired this collection of about 25,000 digital images of rock art from Morocco down to South Africa. So it was using this was the first time that the British Museum had acquired a wholly digital collection. This was that they were registered as objects into the collection. These were not an archive. This was not an ephemeral one. These were born digital objects.
Okay.
So in and of itself, that presents a lot of challenges of how museums approach things, because, you know, museums are inherently built for physical spaces and for physical objects. And when you actually think about it, it really requires a lot of change of how you approach this. So from all the way from our accession documents, all the way up to conservation, to our long-term storage documents, all had to be updated and shifted and policies put into place about how one can engage with born digital objects.
So was this their first, the first born digital objects they had in their entire collection then?
Yeah.
So Ian, not only, it was such a big collection on top of it, not just a couple pieces, but
yeah, it was the first,
over 20,000. Wow.
Exactly. A first entirely born digital. And so, you know, what I always say about this is that the objects are digital images, the subjects of which is rock art.
Okay.
So it's kind of a way to wrap your head around it a bit, because a lot of times, and again, this collection was collected by this organization over 30 years of work across the continent. So in some cases, these images are some of the only records we have of them. A lot of times rock art is extremely susceptible to damage, both by natural and man-made events. And a lot of times this was the only chance we had in there. So the entire collection, the physical collection of rock art remains in situ. The collection that the organization, Trust for African Rock Art, is remaining in Nairobi, we acquired a digital copy of that.
Got it. Okay.
So that is kind of one of the ways that we could play around with it. But one of the things that I absolutely loved about this project, I mean, I loved many, many things about this project. As I mentioned previously, it's how do you wrap your head around all of this new digital technology in a very, very physical world? And this is not digital art. This is digital images of rock art that needs to be treated just as importantly as physical objects. And the rock art does need, you know, barring extremely extenuating circumstances, you know, I'm thinking of things, I can think of a couple examples off the top of my head of damming projects where rock art was going to be destroyed, such as in Peter Mitchell's work in Lesotho with the Metalong Dam. So that was a lot of salvage archaeology. Mm-hmm. And there's another case, Derek Wellesby and the Sudan Archaeological Research Society in Sudan, where rock art was removed. That is the only cases I can think ethically of, you know, situations like that where rock art should not remain in situ.
Sure.
Because those were going to be flooded by damming efforts and were going to be lost. But despite that, I think rock art should remain in situ. And so how does one collect this? How can you look transversally across all of these things? And especially when people are studying rock art, usually, again, you're staying in your one region. How can we work laterally across this? So this actually allowed us to kind of approach a lot of research in new ways. So me and a fantastic team, we cataloged this, made everything available online. And I think one of the really great outcomes of this was, as I said, you're able to look laterally across the continent. Sure. And across some ways to see kind of how things moved and how ideas spread. So, for example, an example I can think off the top of my head is one of our team members, a fantastic archaeologist named Jorge de Torres. He did this great piece of research about camels and representations of camels. You know, they're the iconic image that people think of when they think of the Sahara, but actually camels are very, very new. They only arrived about 2000 years ago, you know, really very, very recently, especially considering how pervasive they are across it. They are likely to have come over from Saudi Arabia. And so as camels, as they were being spread and going west, across the Sahara, it's very distinct in how their representations were done. And especially kind of from very schematic ones in the north and then later ones that became more realistic. So it was almost as if, the trends of how they're integrated. And then also what's fascinating about that is the saddles that camels and how they're represented in that. So, a more Arabian saddle would be on top of the hump, whereas a lot of Western Saharan saddles will actually be in front of the hump. It's more Berber type saddle, or that'll happen there. So you'll see that difference in the depiction of rock art of how people use the saddles differently. And so you can see kind of the spread of, oh, it's on top of it, but this one's in front of it. This is the spread of where people moved. And especially throughout the Sahara, where a lot of people were incredibly migratory, rock art is some of the only thing we have that exists from a lot of these cultures. It is an extension of people's material culture that lived thousands and thousands of years ago.
So was he able to use – was his research then came out of the access to this data? So prior to this kind of project where that information is such a breadth and depth of information, those kinds of studies – then would not have previously been available?
Well, I think it was one of those things that they – putting these all together in one place makes a lot of data available. And it's better – it's easier to laterally go through data and plot things out once you're starting to catalog and make things digitally available. So, I mean, there's been some fantastic research out there on camels. Jorge is definitely not the first person to do that. But I think it's very interesting to see how once you do – and this is kind of one of the benefits of digital collections – and cataloging digital research is making your data available and making it searchable. And so when you're able to pull things like this, like locations and camels, and bring together these big data approaches, you're able to see bigger ones. Helen Anderson on my project, you know, who is a cataloger on my project, also wrote a great paper about representations of chariots. And very similarly, where you're able to plot chariot routes and how these go, and especially with ancient peoples like the Garamantes and people who, you know, populated North Africa, to see how chariots, the representations of chariots would spread across there, and plotting those against known trade routes, and especially to see the different representations. What's really fascinating is that they'll be in places that we know that chariots existed. They'll be usually in profile and these really beautiful detailed pieces. But in some places, there'll be very schematic representations where it'll almost look like a square with two circles on side of it. And what's interesting is that that's probably a representation of somebody seeing a chariot from, you know, up on a rocky outcrop, seeing it go by, but not necessarily having access to it up close.
Okay.
And so that's their representation of the world versus somebody who's used to seeing a chariot, you know, every day. I mean, they would have been prized possessions. These weren't very, very common things to see. But if you were living in a big trading route, you would see it regularly enough to understand the concept of it.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. Is that collection then of rock art, is it continuing to grow? Was that a discrete assemblage that
unfortunately,
one set of born digital images?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think this is just the nature of how projects go in museums. We got a really generous grant from a foundation called the Arcadia Fund to acquire this collection and catalog it and make it available. But unfortunately, you know, that's how funding and research projects work. They tend to be finite. You know, I would love to continually have this grow. But That's not the nature. I do know the Trust for African Rock Art are still acquiring things. They're still doing really, really fantastic work down in Nairobi. I mean, they're based in Nairobi, but they work across the continent. And so hopefully, you know, maybe in the future, this would be able to be expanded. And I mean, this isn't, I do have to say, this isn't the first rock art database. There's plenty of rock art databases out there who do really excellent work. The University of Cologne has a really excellent rock art database. The big one is down at Wits University in South Africa, the Rock Art Research Institute there. There's lots and lots of rock art databases. But the thing that I think is very different about the British Museum's one, and this is something that I think has always drawn me to work in a museum, is we have a dual remit. It's not just for scholarship. And of course, you know, as I said, I'm a researcher at heart. What we need to be doing, but if you want to be a researcher and just a researcher, museums are not the best place for you. You have a duty to make this accessible to the general public. You have a duty to really make research accessible. And I think that's a really, really key differentiation for a museum versus, let's say, a university collection. And that, now, that's not to say that those institutions don't do excellent public outreach. They absolutely do. But it's just a very different way that you would approach this. So when you approach this from a museum standpoint, you need to think about how are you going to translate this? How are you going to make, again, those camels or chariots or some of the fantastic research that's coming out of the project? How do you make this accessible to the widest possible audience? And, you know, yes, we would publish these in academic peer-reviewed journals, but let's kind of back that up a little bit and think about how we can best translate this research to be understandable, but also so people can explore the collection.
And there likely wasn't a model yet at the British Museum, right? Because this kind of collection hadn't existed. So how did you guys think through some of those issues? I mean, that's really, you guys were sort of on the front lines, right?
Yeah.
And thinking in terms of how it can be used by researchers, how it can be used by the general public, how might we think about this in terms of outreach? What are some of those conversations that you guys had?
Absolutely. And I think the thing that is really interesting, kind of just as I'm reflecting on this, I mean, this project started, so, you know, so we started working on this project in 2012. 2013 is when we officially started cataloging. And so it's interesting now, looking back, just from, I'm just kind of having a chuckle to myself from a technological standpoint of some of our early decisions, just how far the industry has shifted, you know, now being in 2018. And it's interesting that speaking now about, again, like digital repositories and things like that, that seems so inherently native to museum work, were very, very new at the time. And so when we approached this, I think the thing that we were really keen on is recognizing that we were a digital collection and recognizing how we could make this accessible to the widest possible audience. And there's one quote that I love, and I'm forgetting who said it. So I hope they'll forgive me if they hear it and they know who it is. But about building digital things, it says, "If you build it, they will come" is not a strategy, it's a prayer. And it's a really great way to approach digital things. And this is something that drives me up the wall about our industry. And I, you know, I'm holding my hand up too and saying I'm guilty of this.
Sure.
Just because you build something and put it online doesn't mean people are going to use it. And it doesn't mean people can find it. And it doesn't mean that people want to use it if you're not necessarily making it as interesting as possible. So when we approach this, again, thinking about this in a really wide possible way, we had these big nebulous terms like engagement and audiences that are thrown around in a museum context constantly. And so it was really quick to kind of define what those actually meant. And to us, for audiences, we had our scholarly audience, we had our general audience, but then we also kind of had an asterisk with both of those, because one of our key parts that we want with both of them is it was really important for us to make this accessible in Africa, in the very, you know, which has incredibly diverse internet usages. So, you know, for example, Cairo or Johannesburg or Nairobi, you know, have really high speed, you know, high speed broadband internet, which is great. But then, you know, you have some challenges in rural areas of people not even just using dial-up internet, but not just mobile first, but mobile only ways of accessing the internet. Recognizing that people are accessing this from internet-enabled phones, so not necessarily smartphones. And so it's kind of that was kind of at the crux of what informed a lot of our decisions.
So that was a priority for
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. It was an absolute number one priority.
Yeah.
Museums really need to, and they are doing a really good job about this, but it's recognizing that digital divide. And especially with collections, where there's active local and source communities, you need to be very, very clear about engaging with them. And I mean, you have to fully recognize the colonial legacy of the British Museum, and you have to fully recognize the colonial legacies and, you know, kind of present tense colonial legacy of a collection of African objects coming from various countries across Africa, you know, and
sure, then and we're starting to see that sort of creep into our nomenclature, the digital colonialism and sort of those
exactly.
ideas too, and kind of exactly. thinking through what that means. And
I think it's something that really needs to be raised. And I'm really glad to hear that these discussions are being had, and especially thinking of it, it's also bringing up major issues of intellectual property, who owns the IP of these things. What makes things available? Who has the responsibility to decide what is the best way to represent these? It's issues that go through museums constantly. And I mean, any kind of cultural heritage institution is debating a lot of these. And the answer is, I don't know. I think it's an ongoing debate. But I think it's important to recognize these challenges of intellectual property, of who speaks for this group, who believes in ownership of this, and especially with objects that are thousands and thousands of years old, can you apply modern political boundaries to these? And how does that actually work with that? So backing up a little bit, access was really important to me, and it was really fundamental to the project of how we designed it. And so we purposely designed our website. And it went through several iterations, again, because it's a 5-year-long project. You need to continually update your website. And this is a challenge also with digital research projects, is often you get a tranche of funding to build a website. You get a tranche of funding to build your database. And then you kind of, at the end of it, everyone shakes hands and pats themselves on the back. And then you walk away because you don't have any funding to update it. You have some minor future proofing, and it's not recognizing the short term nature of this project, of the digital lifespan. You build a gallery, you'll probably get 10 years out of a gallery, you know, of a permanent gallery space. You can probably get longer if it's well done. You'd be lucky to get 3 years out of a website. It just needs to be continually updated and continually adapted. Your content needs to be kept fresh. You need to see how it's actually working. Is it buggy? But then also just refresh it because the technology changes so fast, and making sure it's adaptive and responsive was a challenge. So, I mean, there were things we could do in year 4 and year 5 that we just could not do in year 1 of the project. The technology didn't exist. Or if it existed, it was very much in its infancy. So it really, when you're coming to digital projects like this, it requires a lot of experimentation. So for example, because engagement and audiences were a huge part of this, we had a lecture series where we brought scholars from around the world to come give a lecture at the British Museum on one aspect of rock art and their research. And we were lucky to get some great researchers from Oxford, from University of Western Australia, from Wits University in South Africa. But then what we would do is, and I'm dating it here, we would broadcast that over my Twitter feed via Periscope, you know, and that was popular at the time. Like, this was the thing. This was what, you know, I'm going to aid, like, all the kids are doing it. And I mean, this was before Facebook Live. This was before YouTube Live. This was before any of these other things existed. And Periscope was hugely popular, and it was actually a really great way to create this open access, because you had a really inexpensive way for people to watch a lecture that was given in London to anywhere. You could watch it on your phone and it's in relatively low bandwidth. And so, you know, and then we would record it and we would, you know, make it pretty and put it up on YouTube so people could watch it later. But it was a chance to watch it live. We had a live Twitter and Twitter question and answer session afterwards. So people in the audience could ask questions and then I would read out questions from that people had tweeted in. And I mean, it was pretty amazing to see what this worldwide following of it was. And I fully recognize Periscope is not what people use for that. They probably use Facebook Live and things like that. But you kind of have to harness the zeitgeist at the time and experiment and not, and I kind of laugh at myself now because as I said, it's not really a thing that people use that much now. But you have to harness what is popular at the time and not be afraid to say, oh, well, we tried X and then, you know, it went bankrupt or something like that.
I think that's a great quote there, Elizabeth. Do not be afraid, right? Because when we talk about digital and we talk about some of these new technologies, we have to give ourselves space to try things and not everything's going to work, right? And so having some and recognizing that going in that it's not necessarily going to be out of the box every time. And that there's a lot of experimentation involved.
Absolutely. I think prototyping is a massive part of this as well. It's not just being afraid to fail, but fail well, like don't just try everything. You're not going to have these unlimited resources. But it's also one of the reasons that I'm really pro using open source and free technologies where possible. So for example, don't use an out of the box solution when you can use something that's free and open source. And that's not just for experimentation, but that's also for replication because digital humanities projects, especially well-funded digital humanities projects, and I'm going to put my hand up and say we had a really generous grant, are often seen as it can be almost elitist in the sense of, okay, yeah, you have a big grant. No wonder you can go build all that stuff. So researchers, when we do this, we have a responsibility to use these grants to make things that are replicatable. But, you know, so publish your results, publish what you tried and didn't work. So people who don't have as big of a grant can say, oh, I actually read this paper about a very cool project out of X and they tried this. I can try and replicate it. With these open source technologies. Cause that is really key. And I think that actually really informed a lot of the way that we would work with engagement. So beyond just building this website, which was really great, you know, we would have introductory articles on this website. We would have every country would have an introduction to it. We would have a featured site where we would kind of teach the audience, the general public, how to read a rock art site and talk about context and talk about what this means. So kind of give a breadth and a depth. And then we would have these bigger thematic articles would still be for the general public, but these would be things like geometric figures across East Africa and, you know, kind of these bigger thematic ones that tend to be transnational and just look at the ways that things are represented in a bigger sense. And then we would also link to, of course, to our academic scholarship as well. But we wanted to go a little bit further and we really wanted to push what this idea of access means and what this idea of understanding that, because as great as digital collections are for understanding things, it's really dangerous. And I think it's very true. It's dangerous to just put a lot of stuff online in cultural heritage without context. It can trivialize things. And I'm not saying don't do it. I am one of the biggest digital evangelists you will ever meet, but I'm saying that context is key. And you really think of creative ways that you are explaining that this little piece of rock art doesn't exist in a museum, that this is not just the landscape that it exists in, but the cultural context that it exists in as well. So one of the things that we really tried to do was use this collection and think of how we could build really exciting digital outputs that from this collection that would help build context and also help promote access.
And I would think in this particular case of this particular material, that's because it's so important to keep it in situ and it's so tied to physicality and location and place and landscape that that's even more of a charge with this kind of material that I can imagine.
Absolutely. And it's really key. And it's kind of balancing, as I said, that that double-edged sword of making things as accessible as possible, talking about landscape, talking about location, but also recognizing this is one type of rock art, one type of, you know, archaeology that is extremely susceptible to damage and looting. And so you have to kind of balance the ethical thing of, I want to make people be able to engage with this rock art, whether it's from their culture or not, or they're just interested in it. But you also don't want to make everything so mobile accessible that you've created a shopping list for people to go.
Sure, right? Oh, the wall.
And it is. And that was something that we continually debated about. And so what we ended up saying is that we are going to make all the information that we learn from rock art as accessible as possible, but we are going to be careful about giving people exact locations of where things are. I think, you know, and we did have to make that call, and it was very difficult. So we never embargoed any information about rock art. We published everything we could, open access. We made all the information. So you could still learn a lot from it, but it was just, we're not going to give you our GPS coordinates. That was the end of the day. So we recorded the GPS coordinates, and scholars absolutely can get involved. And we have shared GPS coordinates with other scholars who want to go out with ones, but it just kind of creates that level of filter where people can get in touch with that and say, for example, I'm a researcher in Somaliland. I want to go look at something, and you can direct them towards our colleagues at the ministry, you know, the Ministry of Antiquities in Somaliland or something like that. Because as I said, you know, you have to weigh those challenges. But access is key, and engagement is key. So one of the things we really tried to do was explore this world of kind of shifting a bit here with photogrammetry. So seeing how you can build 3D models out of 2D photographs. Now, usually photogrammetry is done by taking a lot of photos and purpose-built photos, but we had this collection and we wanted to see, could we build 3D models out of historical photos? And it was actually pretty amazing what we could get done. Now, of course, these are not scientific models, but some of them did have scales. So we're able to make relatively scale models of things that went, of these rock art pieces.
Oh, wow.
And we put them up on Sketchfab, which is a very cool website about sharing 3D models. So you can go check out our little models. There's some audio guides on part of them. And it was using historical photos. I mean, one of them we used for photos that were taken in 1997, and we're able to make a pretty complete 3D model out of it. And so it's just interesting to see what you can do with these digital things when you reverse engineer them. And I think some of the stuff that's also really fascinating about that is a lot of these weren't actually born digital images. They were taken on film, you know, in the 80s, and then scanned
and then digitized. Yeah.
And so we were still able to use the data from that. Now, of course, like I said, you're not going to get these incredibly high resolution scientific models. But what you are going to get is a really good example of something that you can zoom around and play with, and you can see how the images relate to each other, the details play. And so that was a really fun part of that. And then what we did is we got those 3D printed, but not in that plastic material that, you know, when you think of a 3D printer. We actually got these 3D printed in gypsum. So how that works is it's stone powder that 3D print like a glue is really the only way that I can describe it. So you end up with something that really feels like a stone, but it's 3D printed. Wow. It's really amazing.
Really neat. And then what did you do with those 3D printed models?
So it was kind of one of those things where we'd use them for engagement, and we'd use them, you know, to show people kind of bringing things back into the physical sphere. But again, talking about access, this is something that I find really important. We would use them for engagement with people who had visual impairments, were blind, partially sighted. It was one way that we, again, because access and increasing, I didn't want any limitations to be able to access this collection, thinking creatively of, okay, who can't access a digital collection? We thought people with, you know, people who are blind and partially sighted, differently abled, sensory challenges, things like that. So when we got these, we were able to actually have sessions. We were able to talk through what they were about to feel. And then we also, for example, in one of our 3D prints, we had an eland, which is a very large antelope. I believe it's actually the largest antelope in Africa. It's very common in South Africa. But we 3D printed what an actual eland felt like, because no one's going to have a mental memory of, you know, if I said a cat, most people in Britain would, you know, even if you're blind, partially sighted, have some sort of something to go off of. So we 3D printed an Eland so you could feel what an Eland felt like in 3D. And then you could finger read the Eland rock art. So you can kind of get an idea of, oh, the horns. Oh, that's the tail. So get an idea of what you actually are, because I think there's also this challenge, you know, working with, there's a challenge here of that, automatically assuming just because somebody might have visual impairments, they know how to finger read, or they know how to, they understand it. That's, it's a bit naive to be like, oh, now everything's accessible. But it's more of thinking about how we can give people an understanding of what rock art is, talking about technique, talking about how, different things, worked. And I think it was a really good chance to, you know, as I said, run these sessions and bring people into the project, that might not have had the chance to do so.
So what are some of the legacies then of that project? Because your grant's done, the project has wrapped up. And like you said, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times with projects like this, you know, the funding ends.
Well, I think one of the biggest legacies we have of that was our way of working. We were very open with how we published, and we worked with some great colleagues around the world, who also work on similar digital humanities projects that are very open. So I think a lot of our legacies as our way of working were, you know, we published a whole bunch about not just our research that we found of it. And we're still, you know, I'm editing a chapter right now. I'm laughing because it's due on Monday. And I'm like, ooh, editing my chapter right now that's in a book talking specifically what I was saying about how we designed our website to be accessible in various parts of Africa, how we design that. So it's not just, I think that's one of the great legacies of digital humanities projects. And if there's one thing I could ask people listening this to take away when they're in their careers, is make sure that you publish your ways of working and your methodology, not just what you are. Because that's as important. It really, really is. So for example, our website, we had this really all singing, all dancing website that we ended up, you know, we had to create a future-proofing plan for this. We ended up taking it down and making a static site because it loads faster and it's better. We found that it worked a lot better through our community partners in various parts of Africa. It worked better, and we really wanted to have the website last as long as possible. It was better to be mobile responsive. And so that seems as like a really old solution of how to handle things. I mean, who still does static sites? But in reality, it actually worked best for us. And so, kind of thinking creatively about how you do it, but publish why you made these decisions.
Some of those lessons learned, and like you said, that you had the resources and to offer some of those institutions that have access to those same kinds of funding resources or talent pool or a variety of different things to get some of the best practices and lessons learned from those kinds of projects. Yeah.
And I think not just as part of this with building this legacy is – just because you have the money, I mean, I'm kind of doing my lessons learned here. Just because you have the money to spend on the best thing doesn't mean that that's the best way to do it. So, for example, we built a virtual reality of one of the sites, Game Pass Shelter in South Africa. Now, one of the reasons that we felt comfortable doing this is this is a UNESCO World Heritage site. It has a guard. It has a visitor center. So we felt that, you know, this was one of the best protected sites. So we felt very comfortable, you know, building this kind of site of understanding landscape. And so, yes, we could have built something really, really high resolution that works really much more immersive as possible. But what we wanted to do is be as accessible as possible. So we built this as a mobile app. It works on, you know, a phone or an Android. It works on an Android or an iPhone and a cardboard headset. So like a Google Cardboard or one of those little ones. We purposely built it in that. And now we know a lot of our community partners are actually using it because they do have access. You do have access to a mobile phone. That isn't something, I mean, in some cases, yes, you don't want to be as othering as possible, but that is one of the most inexpensive ways that we found that we could do it. You know, we could get a whole bunch of cardboard headsets and send them down to community partners. And you can also take it out. You're not asking for these giant, you know, 8,000-pound headsets, which can be incredibly othering. And of course, I'm not, you know, attacking any sort of that type of outputs, because I definitely think that has a place. I really absolutely do believe that has a place. But going back to what my first part of this, the number one goal for me was access and engagement, and making sure that everybody would have access to this, and really not contributing to the digital divide, especially when it comes to knowledge. I think that it's really, you really need to be cognizant of how you practice that, and thinking about how audiences can use this, and also thinking beyond North America and Europe, in people being able to access this knowledge.
Yeah, that's it. That's an important, important considerations. Those are all. So I wonder, where you see the most potential moving forward in terms of digital technologies in the field of heritage?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge question.
Yeah. Personally, I mean, I know not to beat a dead horse here, but I think one of the things that I'm most excited about is access.
Okay.
Is
the
concept of access. Is that...
what good is it, right? What good is it if we can't use it?
We just sit in our ivory towers with our big, you know, virtual reality headsets, and nobody else can come play. And so I think... the thing that I'm really most excited about is access. And I mean certain things, but I mean multiple things by this. I mean access in the concept of anybody can be a researcher. Anybody can have access to peer-reviewed knowledge. I'm a massive proponent of open access publishing. I really believe that things like that need to be published open access, where people can understand the research that is going on, and use technology to make it as available as possible. I also mean access in the sense that people who aren't physically able to travel to London to come to the V&A or the British Museum or any of these museums where research is coming. So you're getting access to what is going on? What is going on display? What is the curation of this? What is the interpretation of this? And then I mean access in this, you know, so building on that is community access of using new technologies to make things available, especially to local and source communities, but not just make them available to local and source communities, but actively engage local and source communities to frame the discussion, because that's very, very important. I think that there's a lot of one-way dialogue of talking at people and being like, this is your heritage. Aren't you excited by this? When in reality, it needs to be really meaningful, long-term engagement. And when you do co-curation, you actively do co-curation. You don't just do this as a tick box exercise of community engagement, that it's really long-term and it's meaningful, and they're having a chance to frame their frame these collections for wider consumption, and that it's okay if you disagree. You know, that's great. That's fine. You know, that's kind of the beauty of dialogues and what's out there. And then I mean access finally in a standpoint of thinking of people who are differently abled. I think that this is a really big and important area that museums are moving forward, of recognizing that, you know, especially not just of open access. I believe museums need to be free. And part of that is also recognizing that just because you're free doesn't mean everybody can come to you. And so recognizing access from a differently abled, from a socioeconomically diverse standpoint, where you come up with solutions of how people can engage with your collection if there's sensory challenges. You come up with solutions of people who might have accessibility challenges, you know, physical or otherwise. But then again, you also recognize that museums are incredibly intimidating, big places, especially in Europe, especially with the, you know, albatross of these colonial legacies. Museums can be violent, upsetting places to a lot of community groups. And using technology to get collections outside of museums, to engage these, to start dialogues, to help not only start dialogues with these communities for the sense of around these objects, but also to learn more how we can change and change the way that we operate, which I think is a very fundamental part of this, because technology is allowing museums to be a lot more self-reflexive and starting to, you know, the V&A I think is doing a really good job of asking big questions and listening, which I think is a really big part of this, of listening to local and source communities to see how the museum is perceived and how we can change, because we do have a responsibility to change and make them more accessible.
Right, right.
Wow.
That's a great access.
Yeah. Well, I asked a big question. So that was, it was an appropriately big answer. That was wonderful. Thank you. So yeah, I'm going to circle back to one quick thing that we sort of touched on in the very beginning, in terms of digital curation, and some of that work that you've done. We actually offer a dual degree in cultural heritage management and digital curation at Hopkins. And so as someone that's actually working in that field and has done that in their professional life, how do you see those intersecting, the heritage management and heritage field and digital curation? How's that intersecting now, and where do you see that moving?
Oh, I think that it's very well dovetailed together. And I think it's only going to become closer and closer. We live in a digital world. You know, the internet is no longer optional of how we approach things. And I also think that the challenge we have with digital is, I always, you know, bring the tone right down. I always think of that Inigo Montoya meme of, you know, you keep saying that word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
Yeah.
Digital is something that's used as this catch-all phrase.
Sure.
Do you mean catalogs? Do you mean the internet? Do you mean, you know,
anymore? Curation is also,
you know,
uses
like,
that word. Yeah.
We do. What are we talking about? And how are we making this publicly available? And so, what I think is great about digital curation and especially digital cultural heritage is you can dip your toe into it as much as you want. It's a scale. You can, you know, continue to do your research and maybe build some interesting posts and things like that and work with a local museum to see how you can translate this research. Or you can, you know, really go all out and build some really amazing outputs that are there. And I think the most fascinating thing that I'm loving that's coming out of kind of this digital humanities, digital cultural heritage industry is a lot of people are incredibly open access, more so than any other sector of anthropology and archaeology or museum work done. Everybody is very pro open access and everybody's sharing their data. Okay, everybody asterisks.
Right.
I mean that in generality sense. And so I think, you know, I'm really excited to see what the students are coming out of this, because a lot of these are just really simple and creative ideas of things. A lot of this came out of stuff and being like, you know what? I like to watch little videos on my phone sometimes when I'm, you know, commuting home. Maybe we should make a little video about this, like a little animation that explains this or something like that. And kind of thinking about how you use technology in your daily life and how we can actually translate that and bring that into the museum and cultural heritage sphere.
Yeah. Wonderful. Oh, it's so good to talk to you today. This has been so fun. And it's, we could talk for a whole nother hour. So, but this has been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Be here. And it was, you know, really wonderful to chat to you. And, as I said, hopefully you can post my Twitter handle. I'd love for any of the podcasts or students, you know, tweet me. I'd love to continue this discussion. And, you know, also come argue with me. I love that too. So
thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for your time.
And I've really particularly enjoy your emphasis on access. That is so,
it's very refreshing to hear. And it's wonderful. It's, you know, it's, talks like this give you hope, you know, as corny as it sounds, it really does though. I mean, it's, I like to see that we're really headed in this direction. It's inspiring. So thank you.
Special thanks again to Elizabeth Galvin. Links to the British Museum's African Rock Art Project can be found on the Cultural Heritage Management Program's website. You can also follow Elizabeth on Twitter @LisaGalvin_. Thank you for joining us for Heritage Unbounded.
Spread the word and invite your friends, and join us again next time for another episode of Heritage Unbounded. Brought to you by the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program in the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, Advanced Academic Programs at Johns Hopkins University. Podcast music features Born 100,000 Years Ago by Cisco Houston from the album The Folkways Years, 1944 to 1961, provided courtesy of Smithsonian Folkways Recordings, copyright 1994 and used by permission.
And I help Brigham Young invent Limburger cheese. Will I sail out on the bay with Methuselah one day, and I saved his flowing whiskers from the breeze.